Welcome to the Mother Love Podcast. This is Claire Larson, your host.
This is a space where guests open their hearts, gather their courage, and tell the truth about what it means to care for these messy and delightful little ones in today's big, wide, and often overwhelming world. We talk about the pressures, the steep learning curves, and the bittersweet reality of watching our children grow. Parenting asks us to be willing to feel it all, celebration and grief, joy and anguish, fear and bravery. So take a breath, let these stories wash over you, and show yourself a little love.
Hi, Mother Love listeners. I'm here with Miranda Maxson today, and very excited to have Miranda on because although we've done one episode about foster care before, Miranda's story is different than that one. And I'm really interested to talk to you, Miranda, about not only your story and what kind of happened while you were growing up in foster care in Montana, but also how you have now sort of turned that table and have become an advocate for other youth that are in that same system. So let's begin with just hello and welcome.
Hi, Claire. Thank you. I am so grateful to be here, and I'm glad that you have me on your show today. As you said previously, my name is Miranda Maxson, and I'm 34 years old. I currently live in Shelby, Montana, which, as some of you might know, is a very cold area during the winter. I have an 8-year-old daughter named Harley and 3 cats.
I didn't know about the cats.
Yep, I have 3 cats. Kind of funny, they're all identical. So they're all black cats and all of them are rescues.
Oh, cool.
Yes. That's so they're kind of kings of the household.
And you just moved to Shelby from Missoula. Cats typically don't love moving from place to place. How'd that go?
You know, it went better than I thought it would. I was able to borrow from a friend. It technically was like a dog kennel for a medium-sized dog.
Okay.
And at the time, I just had 2 cats. I got my 3rd one after I moved up here. But I just stuck them in the kennel together.
Smart.
And they seemed okay. They were very vocal the whole way up here. But they did pretty good.
Yeah.
And then they did the standard hideout for a few days. And now they just love it.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Good. Are they outdoor and indoor cats?
So 2 of them are indoor cats. One of them is like indoor outdoor, and that's mostly because he'll just sneak out anyways. So I let him come and go as he pleases. I did have to put an air tag on him though to find him because he will disappear.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like every time I hear someone has an air tag, I'm like, that's so smart because our dog once in a while escapes and it's just like the worst to wonder where the heck she went. So
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Well, good. I'm glad that you guys made it over and you've been settling in and all of that good stuff. And maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, what we'll circle back to this, but why you moved to Shelby and what brought you from what you were doing in Missoula to what you're doing now.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm sort of from Missoula. I was born in Missoula, but I lived in Clinton in my early childhood, which is a small town right outside of Missoula. Since I've been an adult, I've just lived in Missoula. It's a lovely place. I've had employment there. That's where I met my daughter's father. And essentially, it just came down to money. With COVID and everything that was happening and with the way that prices were going up as far as rent, you know, cost of living, all of those things, I just had to make a decision as to whether I was going to stay in Missoula and struggle or if I was going to move to a smaller town where I wasn't going to struggle as much. And at that time, I was living in a trailer in the KOA park with my daughter, and the trailer was really small, but the property got sold to one of the larger property management. And so I feel like I know what happens to trailer courts when they're eventually bought out by larger companies. And so I figured it was time to go. Mm-hmm. I have a friend that lives up here in Shelby, and she's been encouraging me to move up here for quite some time. So I did finally take the leap, and I had another friend who had a rental available. So I moved up here with a U-Haul, my daughter and the cats, mm-hmm. rented for a little bit, and I was actually able to buy a home up here.
That's so great.
Yeah, it was pretty unbelievable, like, for me, just because in Missoula, I never would have been able to afford to do that.
Yeah.
It's
you and everyone. I know. Yeah. It's so crazy. Yeah.
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 And also, I just thought, you know, it wouldn't be a bad thing for my daughter to experience small town life. I remember back when I was a child and I just kind of had free run, you know, of the area we lived in. And of course, that was back in a time before, like, people had to lock their doors and their cars and things like that.
Yeah.
And it's just a really good community here. My daughter's made some friends. There's more to do here than you would think. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it's family centered.
Yeah.
So that's really good. And she's just having the time of her life.
Mm, that's so great. Yay. Yeah. And so I didn't realize that. Are you working remotely with the work that you're doing right now? Can you talk a little bit about your new work?
Yeah, so actually I am working remotely. The job I had before this, I was also able to work remotely, which is one of the main reasons I moved up here. So this job that I'm currently in is a newer job for me. And essentially, I'm just working with the Quality Improvement Center on engaging youth in finding permanency. So there is a pilot program that's running in Montana. We're one of eight states that is participating. And essentially, what we're doing here is we're trying to give youth a voice in their own care. Mm-hmm. So part of that is going to be we want to develop an implementation model that will focus on how Montana as a state can really engage youth better than we have been historically and in all aspects of their care, but especially when it comes to permanency. So it was kind of funny how I got this job. My official title is Child and Youth Engagement Coordinator. If you can't tell, I'm still getting all the acronyms down.
There are a lot of acronyms in this world. I've joked about that on the show before. I will keep joking about it because it is, I don't understand it, but it's part of the deal.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. But yeah, so I was kind of in between jobs. I had decided that I no longer wanted to continue in the field that I was in prior, which was insurance. Mm-hmm. And I was just kind of at a point in my life where I had, you know, moved up to Shelby and I bought a house. And, you know, I've reached the pinnacle of a lot of my dreams that I had when I was younger. So I was really kind of spending some time thinking about what I wanted to do next with my life. And a long time ago, I would say like 10 years ago now, I participated in a documentary called From Place to Place. And it featured a few children who had aged out of care in the state of Montana. I met a lot of people during that time, really kind of didn't keep in contact with many people from that. But a woman that had participated in that documentary actually reached out to me, and her name is Kimber Haller, and she is also working for the Quality Improvement Center on Engaging Youth in Finding Permanency. And she said she thought she had a job for me that I would be really good at. She explained basically what they were trying to do. I was a little hesitant at first, just because I had taken a really big step back after I did that documentary, because advocacy work can be difficult, especially when it comes to youth who are in foster care.
Yeah.
I feel like everybody's always trying to change things and make things better. A lot of people have really good intentions, but it happens so often that people try to start programs that fail or try to make change that just doesn't stick, or we don't have people that's on the same page.
Right.
So when Kimber described this program to me, it sounded very different from what I've seen before. Just in taking a look at their website, they had some very detailed information on there about what the program is. They had video testimonials from youth who were in care. They're working with several different programs mm-hmm. for this pilot. And I just thought this could be a really good opportunity for me to step back into this type of advocacy work.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's cool because I remember Kimber in the film and she kind of represents what is so common with social work and doing the kind of work that she was doing, which is, you know, cases and cases of trying to help these youth succeed and help them in what seems like really impossible circumstances. And she ends up, you know, during the documentary, having to leave that work because of the emotional toll and because of kind of what comes across in her interview as sort of just this hopelessness and helplessness to do anything. And so I love that she's the one who is like now the connector for something that does seem like it might be really effective. And, you know, instead of being the person who's trying to translate the voice of the kids who are involved so that people will listen, she's like, nope, hand them the mic, you know, like they have their own stories with their own power and let's like finally honor that. So that's so cool.
Yeah, it's definitely been surreal. You know, Montana kind of, we got staffed for our portion of this a little bit later than some of the other states did. So it's definitely been a little bit of jump in and go. Mm-hmm. But I'm really, really excited about what I'm seeing with this program. And one of my main functions, one of the things I was most pleased with is, I mean, there were a few applicants for the position that I'm in, but what they were actually looking for is somebody that had pretty extensive experience being in care in the state of Montana, and they did want somebody a little bit older. And the reason for that is because I'll be developing a team of youth and former youth who have lived experience in the state of Montana, and my job function essentially is just to kind of guide them through this process and to make sure that their voice is being heard throughout this process. So one of my favorite things about this program is that the youth voice is the most important part of all of this.
Yeah.
So there's really this switch to mm-hmm. where, you know, Montana and other states too, it's not just Montana, youth have that are in care have typically been told what's going to happen to them. You know, they're moved, other people make decisions in their lives. And this is really an opportunity for us here to give youth a voice in their own care. We think that it would be a great opportunity for permanency results to turn out good.
Yeah.
Because historically, as you know, most people know, as youth age out of care in Montana, you don't often hear a whole lot for success stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, even in my personal life with those I did keep track of that I was in care with, many of them aren't doing well today.
Yeah.
Some of them are dead.
Yeah.
Some of them are in prison. Many of them have kids of their own who are now going into the system yeah. because their parents are not able to effectively raise them due to, you know, drug use or just some mental health issues that weren't effectively addressed, things like that.
Yeah, it's just incredible. I'm so happy that that's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been a unique experience and I'm looking forward to seeing the outcome.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then let's rewind and go back and talk a little bit more, well, a lot more about what your experience was growing up. And I don't know where you want to begin that story. Like, I know a bit about it, but I'm just going to let you decide the best place to start there and just share what happened.
Sure. Yeah, I can give you just kind of an overview in order to give you a complete one. I guess I can start at the beginning.
Yeah.
So my mother, essentially, you know, I was born in 88, so that was a long time ago. But my mom, unfortunately, was a lifelong drug addict. She probably had some unaddressed mental health issues. So when I was born, everybody just decided it would be best if I was placed with my grandmother at that time, which was her mother, as my mother wasn't really capable of taking care of a child. She was always supposed to come back and get me, but she never really overcame any of her issues. And so just a little over a year later, she actually also dropped my little brother off with my grandmother. So essentially, for the first portion of my life, my brother and I were raised by our grandmother. We lived in Clinton, Montana, and we lived on a small piece of property that my great grandma owned. Money was super, super tight. My grandmother was disabled, and so we had some benefits from the state. But because she couldn't work, we just really didn't have a whole lot of money for things that we needed. By the time I turned 8 years old, she had been diagnosed with a brainstem tumor, and she was no longer able to effectively care for my brother and I. So at that time, my brother had some issues because we were both born pretty prematurely. Both of us were born addicted to substances that my mother had been using, but unfortunately it did affect my brother a little bit more than it did me. He, when he was younger, had a lot of trouble keeping food down. He developed some behavioral issues as we got a little bit older. So at the time I was 8, it was decided that my brother would be sent into care, into a group home type setting where he could potentially be better helped with some of the issues he was experiencing. At that time, I think, you know, he had had some issues with starting fires. There were anger issues, things like that. At that time, I remained with my grandma for a little while longer. Well, it was kind of determined what would happen to me. During that time frame, we actually had a woman reach out to us who turns out was the adoptive mother for another sister that I had. And there was an additional brother that none of us had known about. So my first experience with really leaving home, I wouldn't say it was necessarily going into care, but that occurred when I was sent to live with this woman who was raising my sister. She lived in Billings. I wasn't there for very long. I think at the end of the day, she had really wanted to be able to take custody of my brother. The situation there was pretty unhealthy. I was quite a bit older than my little sister was. There was abuse in the home, neglect. There was just a lot going on. And so eventually I was returned to my grandma. Mm-hmm. After that, I really did enter the system. So I went into a foster home. My brother at this time was still in different group homes. I wasn't really sure where he was at. I want to say I was about 11 when I went into foster care.
Yeah. Can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
What was it like for you when your brother was placed in a group home, but you were still with your grandma? Like, I imagine I'm wondering, with your grandma's, you know, health concerns and things that were going on, were you pretty instrumental in helping to raise your brother? And then was that hard for you when he had to suddenly go? What was that like for you?
Well, that's definitely an interesting question. And there's a few ways I could answer that. So when my brother left, you know, I was young enough that I recognized, of course, that he had some issues. It was extremely hard for me when he did leave, because just due to our financial situation and, of course, being raised by, you know, our grandmother, we both had a difficult time in school. Neither of us really had many friends. I didn't really realize this until later in my life, but my grandmother also had some pretty serious issues, probably mental health related, that probably affected my brother and I both during our time in her care. But my grandma was essentially not a very emotional person. So I spoke with her later in life, and she did acknowledge that she essentially fed and clothed us, but she really didn't have much more interaction with us than that. And, you know, that does come a little bit, I think, from resent of being stuck with your grandkids, which is, you know, not something any grandparent wants. But so I think I recognized he had issues that needed to be worked on, and I had less of those issues. And I think that's why I was able to remain with my grandmother for a little bit longer. I think she maybe had some hopes that I could stay with her, even though she, you know, struggled to care for children, but ultimately she was just too sick and we started clashing. And so I guess when my brother left, I kind of was biding my time because I figured out that at some point I would have to leave too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
I might like have you pause at some points just because I'm always curious.
Yes.
To know the emotional experience. And I feel like that was probably something, like you said, you kind of had to turn off during that time. And so I'm always curious about what that's been like to reflect on, like you said, as an adult, to go back and sort of remember what that really felt like.
Yes. And actually, you know, a lot of the reflection I've been doing on my childhood has actually been because of this position that I've taken.
Yeah.
Because I've always known I struggle with depression, and I always have. And I had some mental health issues diagnosed when I was a teenager. But really, since I've been an adult, I think we each cope in our own way. And my way was to just kind of move on from my situation, because you can't really change what's happened. Right. However, I feel like if you don't address, you know, any kind of trauma or neglect that you've experienced in your life, at some point, it's going to come back and haunt you.
Yeah.
So it's been very surreal because, of course, as I am working through the process of kind of going back into my childhood and really trying to take a look at it, there's a lot of gaps. So there's a lot of things that I just don't remember. And I'm able to recognize now that that is a coping mechanism that a lot of kids have. And, you know, just as I look through some of these things, it's brought up a lot to kind of look back. And one of the things that has really come up for me is that my grandma was not mentally well. Mm-hmm. And during that early time period of my life where I lived with her, my brother and I were severely emotionally neglected and at times physically abused. And unfortunately, that has kind of shaped in some ways who we are as adults.
Yeah.
I've always wondered, I attended college briefly after I aged out of care, and I took a lot of psychology classes. And I think the reason that I did that is I was always trying to understand what was wrong with me.
Yeah.
Because I just wasn't quite the same as, you know, other people my age that I was interacting with. I had started to have relationship problems. You know, I'm not a very physical person even now. That's something I'm working on. But a lot of the ways that I deal with life, I'm realizing are just coping mechanisms from a time when I needed to not be close to people.
Yeah.
And so it's been helpful to acknowledge some of that because I'm able to address it as an adult and start trying to be at peace with myself. Because if I want to be able to help others that are currently, you know, in foster care, in state care, I really do need to be at peace with myself. And that's just something I haven't really allowed myself to do, I think, throughout my adult life.
Right. Right. And a lot of the people you'll be working with are going to be actively feeling the things that you as a coping mechanism, like you said, had to sort of be like, okay, close case, chapter done, moving on, you know, and not that they're, that seems to make perfect sense to me if you're going to like live an adult life and not have to be stuck in all of those memories all the time and reopening all the trauma. But when you're working with people who are actively in that, if you're not able to like feel like or be comfortable with them talking about the things that they're feeling now as it's happening, it's going to be a lot harder, I think, to, I don't know, just to be present with them and to encourage them to express those things when you weren't able to express them yourself, right?
Exactly. And, you know, another part of that is my time in care was quite a while ago. Mm-hmm. So I aged out of care in 2007 and things were different then. So the way that I aged out of care is not necessarily how people and children are aging out of care today. part of what I'm doing is acknowledging that there was a lot of, you know, things that occurred in my time in care where that shouldn't have occurred. There was help that I should have gotten but never did. And, you know, just kind of looking at what's going on with youth in care today to see some of the resources that are out there, it can be at times a little saddening for me.
Yeah.
And I really need to be able to sit well with myself, because even though I didn't get a lot of the help that I should have had back then, the point of this position that I'm in now is to make sure that youth in care are getting all of the help that they should be getting. They should be getting the tools that they need to advocate for themselves and what they want.
Right.
And so in a lot of ways, I'm really glad that it was different. I'm glad that I'm older than the youth that are in care that I'm working with now. It's good to see some of the changes that have been made, but it's also just really, really saddening to see that it's just nowhere near enough.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so interesting to think about. Okay. Well, I interrupted you right as you were going into the next part of your story. So carry on, because I think you left off that was when you kind of formally entered care.
Yeah. So when I formally entered care, I believe my first placement was a foster family. Given my age, I was probably about 11, maybe 12 when this was occurring. It came to a point, and this is where I have some of those gaps in memory where I'm not always able to remember everything that happened. But I do remember, you know, it was awkward living with a new family that I didn't know, you know, having to deal with a caseworker, understanding that my grandma was too sick to, you know, take care of me, but not understanding why I couldn't go to another family member, or why I was in, you know, a foster home where I felt I wasn't liked. Mm-hmm. It is a really hard feeling to explain. And I believe that the foster family did, you know, they tried their best. I'm sure they'd fostered other kids, but ultimately it was decided that I wasn't a good fit for the home. However, they didn't let me know that. So, you know, my first real experience with going into actual state care was my foster dad asking me if I would get in the car and help him find a friend's house. So I did, you know, I got in the car and essentially I was dropped off at my first group home. And the reason it was done that way is, I guess, my caseworker at the time had advised them not to tell me that I was moving into a group home because they considered me a run risk, even though I'd never run away before. And I would say that was probably one of the most traumatic experiences I've ever had in my life. I'm sure others can relate to this feeling I felt, because when you are just so shocked or in such fear that, I mean, you can't even tell which way is up. It's just, you can't even grasp what's happening at all. So I moved through, you know, the orientation process, but I don't recall taking in any of the information because I could barely see or walk. I was just so stunned. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like I was outside of my body. And I think at that point in time, I probably had a shift in who I was as a child. So when I entered the system, I would say I had minimal behavioral problems. I liked to read a lot. I got good grades. But I think the day that I was put in that group home probably was when my mentality switched. And during the rest of my time in care, I developed some pretty major behavioral issues. I, you know, had some mental health problems that were being addressed with medication. I did start to run away from different group homes and foster homes. I became resentful. I became hateful. I ended up in a couple of treatment centers due to my behavior. You know, one of the facilities I was in was in state, and I did manage to, I mean, I ran away from there too. And I spent a month in jail at that time. And I spent my 13th birthday in jail, just kind of sitting there waiting for them to decide if they were going to send me back to the treatment center or what they were going to do with me. One memory I do have from that time period that's pretty clear is, you know, they kept me on the juvenile detention side. And I minded my own business. I followed the rules. And I do remember a female guard at midnight woke me up, and she came in and she sang me happy birthday on my birthday at midnight. And this is probably the first time I've ever admitted this, but I mean, I just cried, and she, you know, held me. Because that's just such a surreal situation. I mean, if you think about it, I was grateful somebody remembered it was my birthday, though. I was eventually sent back to that treatment center, but I ended up being removed because there were issues with the staff, unfortunately, behaving inappropriately with some of the people that they were supposed to be helping. This was a lockdown facility, so none of the youth that were in there could really get away from any of the staff. So unfortunately, I do think that's a great opportunity for certain people with tendencies to be predators to prey on children that nobody's going to listen to.
Yeah.
I, at that time, was grateful I had a good caseworker who did listen to me, and she removed me from that treatment center. I spent some time in a treatment center out of state. I spent about 16 months there, and this would have been, I was probably about 15 and 16. It was a standout place for me. It's something I still have nightmares about. In my time there, several of the other youth that, two at least, of the other youth that I was housed with killed themselves there.
Oh my gosh.
There was abuse and neglect that was not addressed. I wasn't able to contact, you know, a caseworker like I would have been able to before during some of this time. They used isolation and restraints and medical chemical restraints as a form of punishment. And when it wasn't being used as a punishment, it was being used as a way to make the youth that were in there less bothersome. So there was a period of time in that 16 months, and I want to say it was a 6 or 7 month period where I didn't go outside. In that facility, that is the place I did. I also tried to kill myself. I spent months in isolation, and, you know, it just was not healthy. It was really bad. And I do credit that place with, I was a stubborn child, and really that's all I had left to me at that point was me and my anger and my stubbornness. And I do credit that place with essentially breaking me, which was the point, I think. So by the time I left, I was pretty well behaved, but I feel like I had lost in that time.
Like, at what cost?
Yeah. A bit of the humanity that I had left, I think, disappeared. And I'm not saying, you know, I'm some kind of monster ever thought I was, but it definitely was a defining moment that changed the way that I viewed the world and the people and the things in it. There was an incident. At one point, my brother and I ended up in the same facility, but we were on different units. And that wasn't supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. But we weren't aware. I hadn't seen him in years, and he hadn't seen me, and they weren't aware that they'd placed siblings in the same facility. So, I mean, that was pretty traumatic in itself, seeing my brother for the first time in years as I pass him in a hallway on another unit. And then once they had figured out what had happened, they did, you know, allow us one or two visits before I think I was transferred out of that facility. But there really wasn't an effort made to keep siblings together during my time in care. So my brother and I were not placed together at any point after either one of us was in care.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. There's like so much there. This is one of those things that's so interesting about people sharing their lived experience and people sharing their stories is, like, I'm hearing it for the first time. So, like, you know, being a mom, and this is something I wanted to talk to you about too, but, like, being a mom and just thinking of our kids in those kinds of situations is, like, I can't not get emotional about it. And I'm just so sorry that all of that happened to you. And when we were talking before, you know, we were talking about what it's been like for you to be a mom. And, you know, I mean, I don't know. I don't even like know how to say it, but it's, I imagine that for you, it, as she gets closer to the age that you were when some of these really traumatic things happened, like, is it even harder for you to think about like yourself at that age because you have this like sweet, innocent, pure, full of life little girl, like living out her life in a safe home with love and care? You know, what's that like for you to be momming someone?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up. So it is interesting because my daughter is 8 years old. And as I said previously, that is, you know, that is about the time, you know, my life started changing in major ways. At that point in my life, I had already listened to learn, or I had learned to listen for footsteps, or I had learned to like watch my grandmother's face to see what kind of mood she was in. Yeah. I had learned to be silent. I had learned that she didn't want to hear what I had to say. And so it's funny, my daughter is one of the most happy-go-lucky children I've ever seen. When I first found out I was pregnant, and I will tell other mothers this, I really don't have any shame in it because it's something that people just, you know, they don't really talk about, but it's necessary to talk about it. When I found out that I was pregnant with my daughter, I cried. Mm-hmm. And they weren't happy tears because I think a piece of me, like a little childhood piece of me, had always wanted to be a mother. And when I found out that I was pregnant, I realized I had no idea how to be a mother. Mm-hmm. The way I was living my adult life, the timing, everything was just wrong. Like, I knew I had problems as an adult. I'd really struggled. At one point in time, I had been court ordered into an adult group home because when I aged out, I had a complete meltdown. I was not able to care for myself. I didn't have any life skills. I didn't know how to do anything.
Well, how would you?
Exactly. Yeah. At that time, you know, not the youth that were in care weren't really taught much about what happens after you age out of care, because honestly, the state's involvement ends mm-hmm. on your 18th birthday. And unfortunately at that time, it didn't matter what happened to you. You right. weren't their problem anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, I followed through with having my daughter, and I knew immediately when she was born, I had a very difficult labor. But as soon as I laid eyes on her, I felt, I think, this feeling that I had not since, or like not beforehand, had I ever felt that sensation, and even since her birth. I think it's a very unique feeling that you have when you create a child and you're holding them in your arms and the child yeah. is yours.
Yeah.
And I just knew, I think it was a strong love. I was also really afraid, you know, afterwards. I didn't know it at the time, but probably what I was dealing with was postpartum depression. Mm-hmm. At the time, you know, her father and I were married, and he's a wonderful father now. You know, we are not together anymore, but we communicate well for our daughter's sake. And, you know, at that time, I had to completely change my life in order to keep this tiny baby safe. And I didn't know what to do with her. I, you know, she's just looking at me and I'm like, oh my gosh. And unfortunately, my husband at the time was not particularly interested in changing his lifestyle. So I found myself often very alone. It was me and that baby, Miss Harley, and it was a very interesting time. There's a lot of emotions that, you know, run through a new mother, but I didn't really have any family left. I didn't have anybody I could reach out to, so I often spent a lot of time alone with mm-hmm. my daughter, and it wasn't easy mentally or, you know, just knowing what to do.
Right.
And at some point in time, I figured out, like, in order to be a mother, I had to stop being terrified that I didn't know what to do and just really sit with the fact that although I didn't know what to do, I knew what not to do. Mm-hmm. And so I just focused on not doing the things I shouldn't do. And, you know, over time, her father and I did fully separate, you know, and it's been good ever since. But I think one of the hardest times in my life was when my daughter was an infant. There definitely was some times where she would just cry and my husband wouldn't be home because he hadn't come home from work, and she would just cry and scream, and nothing I did for her helped her, and I was so alone. And, you know, there definitely was a period of time where I had to put her down. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of women go through that. And at that time I didn't know what that was, but
right.
I was dealing with a baby and I was dealing with her alone and I didn't know what I was doing. And there was a core part of me that knew in that moment I had to put her down, even though she was crying, and I had to leave my home. Yeah. I had to walk outside and shut the door and let her cry. And I cried outside and thinking, you know, I almost shook my daughter.
Yeah.
And I did. Like, yeah. I almost shook my daughter.
Yeah.
And, you know, that memory is one that I'll have for the rest of my life. And, you know, I'm very honest and open with my daughter about life.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had some discussions about this, but I think it's definitely something that just doesn't really get talked about. And especially when it comes to somebody like me, mm-hmm. you know, that doesn't really have, or at that time, I didn't have family to reach out to.
Right.
And I was trying to parent when I really had no business being a parent at that time.
Yeah.
My daughter and I, of course, made it through, and she's the light of my life. And, you know, everything that I do for my daughter. Mm-hmm. I make sure that I'm well mm-hmm. mentally, and I make sure that I can provide. I make sure I keep employment. Mm-hmm. She's the driving force in my life. And honestly, I've grown a lot with my daughter. Yeah. In a lot of ways, she saved me. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds like a terrible thing for a mother to say, that your child is responsible for saving you, because that's a hard thing to say and look at. But in a lot of ways, she did. She gave me this feeling, and, you know, it's love mm-hmm. that I was missing and wasn't able to give to anyone else. And I think over time I realized that although I'm not capable, you know, due to childhood events, of handling my emotions the way that everybody else does, there was a piece of me still left, and I still had love to give to her.
Yep.
And that really was a profound moment for me, realizing what that feeling was, and that it was there every day, and I would do anything for my daughter. And it was really hard to watch others in my life, or like other people who had been in care with me, you know, not be able to parent.
Yeah.
It's hard. Even my own brother, you know, he has several children. He's not capable of caring for them. Mm-hmm. He doesn't understand that, you know, his children are going into the state care themselves, or they're living with single mothers, or, you know, some of them are in foster care. And it's just really hard to watch.
Yeah.
But that really, unfortunately, it is often the story for, you know, youth that age out of care.
Yeah. And I don't think any of that is, you know, like you said, awful to say. I think that there are a lot of moms who come from a lot of backgrounds and a lot of circumstances, you know, who in one way or another didn't have the unconditional love that they needed as a kid. And whether it's like substance use or trauma, or even sometimes I think kids who come from wealthy families but have really emotionally shut off parents and experience neglect in a really different way, that when once that feeling of love comes over them with their with their own children, it is like a switch that can be flipped. And like you said, it doesn't always happen, but it's something to hold on to in those like really dark times when like you don't have it within you to hold on. So you do like think of your baby's sweet little face or their chubby little thighs or whatever. And like, there's something instinctively in us that like, it's like our survival instinct goes up because we're surviving for two people and not just ourselves. Right. And it's really powerful. So I think that when kids come along and you're able to heal alongside them as they grow, it's like a really beautiful, rare opportunity.
Yeah, it definitely has been. And, you know, I agree with you. As I, you know, mentioned before, I've always struggled with depression. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I work on myself now, you know, there's much more going on, but I'm making the right choices. I'm seeking the help that I probably should have sought out a long time ago. But before I did that, I just tried to treat myself, I guess, in whatever way that I could. And, you know, there was definitely bad days when my daughter was little and it was really hard for me to get out of bed. I was, you know, oversleeping, but it really is powerful, that drive, when you have a small child who depends on you. Like, you can't just give up. And so it was like a little voice in the back of my head that said, get up, you have to get up, get up. You can't sit here. And every time something would go wrong or finances were bad or I had, you know, medical collections come and take everything out of my bank account because I didn't have insurance, you know, when I'm working three jobs and I'm just ready to just give up because nothing ever goes right and everything's falling apart and there's not enough food and there's not enough money and there's not enough diapers. Like, it's so easy to just want to give up. Yeah. But I mean, again, it's that voice in the back of my head that said, you can't, yeah, you can't give up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've really done a lot of growing, you know, since I've had my daughter, and my financial situation is different now. Mm-hmm. I've been able to, you know, make a way for myself, make a home for myself. I'm not so impoverished I'm, you know, having to go to the food bank anymore or mm-hmm. having to ask for diaper donations, mm-hmm. you know, things like that. And in a lot of ways I can turn around now and give back, yeah, because, you know, there are other women that, especially women and girls who have been in care, that are going through, will go through, or have gone through exactly what I went through.
Yep.
And not all of us make it out of that.
Right.
So this, I mean, it's important for me to recognize that. My daughter knows where I come from. She knows, you know, what the system is, and she knows, you know, what the situation is with my brother. And I do have a lot of people that are uncomfortable with the level of honesty I have with my daughter. But I think it's very important for her to see, you know, where adults come from, and that, you know, there's many different ways a story can turn out.
Yeah.
One of the more recent conversations I had to have with my daughter this January, I was in my second alcohol-fueled car wreck, where I unfortunately rolled my car into a field, and I'm extremely lucky that I lived through that. And this is the second time in the space of a year that I'd been in a car accident because of my drinking, mm-hmm. and was lucky to get out alive. First, when I hit the very end of a guardrail, mm-hmm. and I don't know how I made it out of that one alive, but, you know, with my daughter, I am honest with her. I think it's important that our children see that adults can, in fact, fail. Mm-hmm. But on the other side of that, I think it's important for children to see that adults can correct their mistakes.
Yep.
So, you know, as far as myself, I'd always congratulated myself because my mother was a drug addict. My brother was a drug addict. And I just congratulated myself because I wasn't a drug addict. Well, turns out I had a pretty serious drinking problem. Mm-hmm. And it was something I needed to address. So, you know, I've been honest with my daughter about that. It did encourage me to seek the help that I needed to seek. I told her about my fines and what it was like to go to court, and that, yes, even though I was seeking the help I needed now, I still had consequences to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important for children to see. And, you know, this has definitely been a year of extra growth for both my daughter and I. And I think that's really positive. I think that we as parents have that responsibility to our children to not sugarcoat things, you know, show them all of the good things in life. Make sure they see that, but also make sure they're aware that life isn't perfect and adults aren't perfect.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's important that I make sure she knows that she always has a voice. She can always come and talk to me.
Yeah.
That's definitely something I didn't have as a kid. I felt like I oftentimes was not listened to. And that's one of my primary goals with my daughter, is I want to make sure she's always listened to.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think it's really important to let our kids see our flaws and like, and you know, like make sure they feel safe and not responsible for it or whatever, but also just the piece of like what it looks like you said, to fall down and get back up, you know, because I think that they're going to fall down and need to get back up. And if they've had examples of that, it's really, really important.
Yes, it is. It's greatly important. And, you know, at the end of the day, like, it's also important for me because I'm able to look at myself in the mirror and know that I'm doing everything I can for my daughter. Even though, you know, I may have my own struggles, I'm able to provide my daughter a healthy and happy lifestyle. Yeah. And that feels amazing.
I'm sure. Yeah, it's probably everything to you.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you mind sharing a little bit more about some of the things that have helped? Like, you know, do you have like a faith and spirituality practice? Have you been seeking like counseling or therapy? Or do you mind kind of going into some of the things? I think that healing looks really different for everyone. And I'm always just interested in like, what has healing looked like for you so far?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, when I aged out of care, I really did not do well. So I basically made survival choices. You know, I had been on a lot of different medications, but I lost access to my Medicaid when I aged out. So I had to completely...
That alone is crazy.
Yeah. And it was pretty horrible. You know, I couldn't access the mental health medication that I needed. So I just taught myself how to manage myself, which I'm putting a disclaimer on there. That's not okay.
No,
I don't recommend it. I guess in my own way, like I did what I needed to do to survive, but I went completely unmedicated up until fairly recently.
Mm-hmm.
Healing for me, really, it took me almost dying twice to realize I needed help. Because I honestly didn't care, you know, that much about myself. I did care about my daughter, I would never, you know, put my daughter in a bad situation. But it took almost, you know, being so close to possibly dying to realize that if I die, like, although maybe I don't care about myself as much as I should, like, my daughter cares about me. And where does that leave her?
Mm-hmm.
So that was really a driving force in me seeking. I did seek out a counselor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I sought out some help for my drinking. And that is where, you know, I have a problem with, I have this need to be in control of everything and do everything myself and fix it all myself. And again, that's a coping mechanism you know, being a kid. And sometimes things just are too heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken me till I've, you know, I'm 34, and I really had to sit down and realize I had to ask for help with some of these things because I just couldn't do it all on my own. And so I wish if I could go back in time, back to that time when I aged out of care, and if I could have advocated for myself, been in a position to do that, like, I didn't have to spend all of those years trying to manage my mental health issues on my own. Right. And to be honest, I've spent most of my adult life in absolute misery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, seeking the help with, I have a great therapist. I see her often.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm taking the medication I need to take now. I'm making the choices that need to be made for the benefit mm-hmm. of myself and my family. And it's interesting because, like, I don't know, like, I don't have to spend every day just being exhausted yeah. and sad and empty, because part of that was my mental health I wasn't treating, but part of it was just doing everything myself. And yeah. it's quite a relief to be able to just sit down and talk to somebody.
Yeah.
And I wish I had done that a long time ago.
Yeah.
I wish I had really sought that self-care for myself all those years ago. And so although my life definitely isn't perfect now, I'm in a good place yeah. and I'm not spending all of my time in just this negative mind frame. I'm able yeah. to find things that make me happy. This year, I have plants. I've never really owned plants in my life yeah. before. But I remember somebody asking me probably about February. They're like, well, what are your hobbies? And I had to really think about
like surviving.
It. Yeah,
surviving is my main hobby. Yeah.
Because I didn't have any left.
Yeah.
I couldn't list one.
Totally.
And so I started buying a bunch of plants. And, you know, not all of them have made it through. But I, when people come to my house now, they're like, whoa, because I have just a ton of plants.
That's awesome.
And it's been good. And it's been something that I can, you know, do with my daughter and we're learning about plants together and, you know, what makes one thrive will make the other one die. So
yeah,
it's good. I would have to say, you know, at the end of the day, I am good with my yeah. life and yeah. I'm at peace and the pieces that I'm not at peace with, I will be at peace with. Mm-hmm. And it just puts me in a really good place.
Yeah. That's amazing. I love it. Plants are good for depressed people. I speak from experience. Well, because it's like, it's not that much, but you can do it at home. You can like, you know, and you see the results of them doing well. And if one doesn't do well, you're like, oh, okay. I'm out $4.99 or whatever. Like,
exactly.
We start over. Yeah.
And you know, it definitely helped me because, you know, when I got the first plant, it was literally a result of me being asking myself, what now? Like, yeah. what do I do now?
Yeah.
And I didn't have the answer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at that time, my daughter was with her father and it was too quiet and I was too still. And mm-hmm. so it was really nice to... I figured I liked plants, so I went and I got one plant, and then I got a bunch of seeds, and it kept me busy. It gave yeah, me yeah. a purpose, and it was really good.
That's awesome. Yeah. Okay, so a couple more questions before we kind of wrap up, but sort of bringing this back to how all of your experiences that you've gone through and the growth that you've gone through, you know, have now put you in this position to serve others, and both the youth, but the people who are trying to make a difference, but don't know how to do it well, right? So I'm curious about what has changed since you were in care, you know, to today. And although there are still miles and miles to go, like, what do you see as some of the most important changes that have been made from the time that you were in care until now? And then what would you say are some of the things that like you hope to accomplish when you start with this pilot program that like that seem clear to you, like this clearly still needs to change and improve?
Yeah. So I would say, you know, since my time in care, a lot definitely has changed for the youth that are currently in care and currently aging out. One of the main things I've noticed is there's just a ton of resources. So a lot of youth are being offered, you know, independent living classes. They're encouraged to get jobs. They're being taught life skills. They're able to talk more with their caseworkers. there is a lot that's going on, and especially in the aspect of, you know, what happens to you after you turn 18. But that being said, a lot of youth who are in care or aging out of care, a lot of them don't, they still don't have an understanding as to why they're in care. They don't always have the knowledge. They're often left out of conversations and courtrooms. And there is just a plethora of adults who are tasked with making decisions for them. And oftentimes, those decisions don't include the youth. That's problematic. That's extremely problematic, because if you don't include the youth in, you know, their own permanency plans, I don't know how you can expect a good outcome.
Right.
They really need to be present. And I mean, fully present. They need to be invited to the table, but not only like invited to the table, they need to be given a voice. Mm-hmm. They need to know what's going on. So one of my main hopes in this position that I'm in now is that ultimately, the outcome of this will be that youth are not left in the dark. A lot of people think, they ask themselves the question, well, at what age is appropriate? Like, how much information is appropriate? And that's a valid question. But at the same time, I mean, youth are not, especially youth in care, they need answers. The situation is already not age appropriate. If you think about it, being removed from your family and shoved with a bunch of strangers and then transferred, and then not even to mention the trauma you've experienced prior to that, the entire situation, I mean, we've exited the land where the excuse that it's, you know, these conversations aren't age appropriate. Like, you can't, we can't use that as an excuse anymore.
Yeah.
And the outcomes aren't good when they're not involved in their own care. So my biggest hope in the work that I'm doing now is that youth will not be left out of any part of their care, and that they will have the tools that they need to advocate for themselves. And if somebody involved in their care isn't doing their job or including them, they will have the resources they need to reach out to someone else to write that.
Right.
If a youth can't advocate for themselves throughout this, I don't know how they're expected to advocate for themselves as they become an adult and exit the system. I just don't. So it's important. And that's definitely why I was excited to take this position, because the youth are the most important part of the system. It's why they're why it's there. And we want youth to be able to age out and become productive, healthy, and happy members of society. And right now, that's just not always what we're getting. It's improved, but it's still just not enough.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Okay. Well, I always like to end with like a few kind of fun questions.
Sure.
Because, well, because it's fun to end with fun questions. But
yes.
Before we do that, I'm really honored to be working with you. And, you know, we get to present together next week at the AWARE Summit, where you'll share your story to continue to encourage people who have some authority in this to create change and do better. And I think that the fact that people sharing their stories is becoming more of a valuable asset when moving forward with creating programs and creating systematic change. Like, it's really hopeful to me that we're not just basing this on assumptions of people who have no idea what it's like, right? So I'm just really grateful that we can work together on this. And I'm absolutely just like in awe of you and your story and what you've been through and how you guys are doing now. And I just commend you for the healing and growth that you've gone through.
Thank you. And, you know, it goes two ways. I'm excited that, you know, you have me on this podcast. I didn't know about this podcast prior to meeting you. And now that I found it, I have listened to several of the episodes, and I have definitely told a lot of people about it because we are in a day and age where, I mean, tech, you can get the information and support you need. And I love podcasts. Mm-hmm. So do most of the other people that I know. And I think this podcast could be an amazing tool for anybody that's, you know, dealing with parenthood or even not. Yeah. So I am so grateful that you had me here today to be on your podcast.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it's one way to break through the isolation piece, I think, that is so hard when you're, especially when you're a new mom, it can be really isolating. And if you don't have family or you don't have close friends, or even if you do, but you don't want anyone to come over because stuff is so hard, it's like a way to connect without having to do a lot of other scary stuff. You just put your headphones in and give it a go. So, yeah. Okay. So I'll just fire a few questions at you and then we can wrap up.
Okay.
But I stole this first one from Brené Brown, which I don't know if you listened to her podcast called Unlocking Us. It's good. But her favorite rapid fire question of mine is, what is on your nightstand, like on a typical night? Like, what's on your nightstand? That's one of my favorites.
Oh my gosh. So that's kind of a funny question. My nightstand is kind of my catch-all. So it's got two drawers and I usually try to hide like everything in the drawers. But currently right now, I definitely have three books on my nightstand, one of which I'm almost done with and two that I'm trying to encourage myself to read. I have a lamp. I have a candle and I also have a notebook that is just kind of a therapy notebook. And I leave it on the nightstand because I'm constantly forgetting to do things like write in the notebook. And it encourages me to write in that.
Yeah, I love it. That's great. Yeah. One of the funniest responses, I think, when I was hearing her interview someone, they were like, NyQuil. And like, it was just all this stuff that was like really, really random, but tells you a lot about the people. So
right.
I love that. I also have like always five or six books on my nightstand or like in my bed with me. Like I'll wake up and be like,
yes.
Okay.
It's there.
Yeah. What's something that your daughter does that reminds you of you when you were a kid?
Oh my gosh, this one's also funny. So recently I have discovered when I was a kid, I struggled with expressing myself without getting kind of mad. And I guess when I was her age, I would tend to throw tantrums. There's just no other way to really put that. I would just screw my face up and ball my fists up and get loud. Mm-hmm. And I have recently discovered that my daughter does the same thing. It reminds me of me. And you know, the saying that they always say, like, you know, your daughter will, you'll regret being the way that you were because your daughter will show you how you were. Yeah. And it really is true. I also used to slam doors when I was a kid, and it is kind of, don't tell my daughter this, it's kind of entertaining because she'll get upset, and sometimes I'll ask her to go to her room to take a few minutes, and she does. She'll go to her room, but her door doesn't sit like center, and so it doesn't close all the way unless you really pull on it.
Oh, man.
She'll try to slam her door, and it doesn't work out for her because she's not strong enough to push it all the way closed in a slam, she'll give it a go two or three times, and then eventually she just gives up and shoves it shut, but I have to quietly giggle about that to myself because I don't want her to know that it's kind of cute when she does that. I don't support slamming doors, but it's cute kind of.
That would make me so mad if it didn't slam though. It's like those drawers that people have that like slowly close that if I were trying to slam a drawer and it slowly closed, I don't know, that would make me lose it even more, I think. But yeah. Okay, so we're kind of like close to out of time. So I'm just going to choose one more, which is if you could think back and just name like one person on this journey, like you already mentioned, and I don't think I'll ever forget the guard who sung you happy birthday. Like that's just such a powerful, vivid moment. But was there anyone else on your journey that really stands out that like was kind of like that same, like a light in the darkness and made a difference that you still think of today?
Yeah, there actually is. And this is something that I've been discussing with some of the people that I work with. you know, during my time in care, I had a lot of different caseworkers, but there was one that stood out. I think she was probably a newer caseworker at that time, because casework is definitely hard work.
Yeah.
But she, I do remember her because she's the one I mentioned earlier that listened to me and was removed me from a bad situation. But she would just call to check in on me sometimes, and she would ask me questions about my life, which was new. Nobody was really asking me about my life. If she had to transport me somewhere, you know, she would oftentimes buy me McDonald's, which was something I just didn't get otherwise. Yeah. And she probably doesn't remember me. I'm probably one of so many kids that, you know, she served, but I do remember her. Mm-hmm. Even after all this time, I just, her heart was good. And in a lot of ways, she treated me like the child that I was, instead of, you know, just a youth who was on her caseload. Mm-hmm. She gave me a little tiny piece of my childhood back that I had lost. And I'm forever grateful to her for that.
Yeah, it's crazy how much those little things make all the difference, right?
It really is the little things. Yeah. And I always try to remember that as an adult, and especially with my daughter. Like, I'm like, I got to remember about the little things, because they matter.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, thank you so, so, so much. I'm so glad that we got to do this today.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
Mother Love exists to help our guests and listeners honor and embrace their own stories and experiences. If the content in this podcast has caused you concern or distress, please reach out to someone you trust for support. Speaking up about our struggles is half the battle, and there are many providers who can and want to help. Visit our statewide online resource guide at www.hmhb-lifts.org to help you find resources in your area. Mother Love is hosted by Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies, the Montana Coalition, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the health and well-being of families who are expecting or raising little ones. Opinions and views expressed in these interviews do not necessarily represent the views of HMHB as an organization. We sincerely value the lived experiences shared on Mother Love, and we understand that not everyone will agree with or relate to all of what is shared. Thank you to our incredible editor and producer, Brooke Boone Miller, for sharing her gifts with us. She is a mom, and she gets it, and for that we are so grateful.